I'm Tom Hall. This is the Midday News Wrap. Today, how Healthy Holly, the pint-sized protagonist in a series of children's books by Baltimore Mayor Catherine Pugh, became the moniker for a $500,000 scandal. Baltimore Sun reporter Luke Broadwater joins me with the latest in the developing story that has engulfed City Hall and the University of Maryland medical system and prompted emergency legislation in Annapolis. And Governor Hogan slams Democrats as spendthrifts, and former Baltimore mayors make the case to keep the Preakness at Pimlico. WIPR's Rachel Bay and The Sun's Pamela Wood join us with an update from the Maryland General Assembly. Plus, the local Honeys perform live in Studio A ahead of this weekend's inaugural Baltimore Old Time Music Festival. Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. I'm Tom Hall. It's the Midday News Wrap today. On the international stage, President Trump seemed to insert himself into Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's re-election bid by reversing course on a long-standing U.S. policy concerning Israel's sovereignty over the Golan Heights, land that Israel seized in 1967 and annexed in 1981. Here at home, there are a lot of folks who believe a report from Special Counsel Robert Mueller is imminent, although, as always, the Special Counsel's office has made no announcement that a report is forthcoming. Some have even attributed the president's tweet storm last weekend to his nervousness about what the report might say. But, of course, all of this is pure speculation. What's clear is that the president continues to have some success in convincing a slice of the electorate, mostly Republicans, that the Mueller investigation is an unwarranted witch hunt. And the mayor of Baltimore seems to think that witch hunts aren't limited to the Trump administration. As developments in the ever-evolving saga of the University of Maryland medical system continue to unfold, Mayor Catherine Pugh is in the eye of the storm amid allegations of conflict of interest and self-dealing by her and nearly a third of the UMMS board. In just a bit, we'll check in with Rachel Bay and Pamela Wood to hear about what else is going on in Annapolis at the General Assembly. But now we turn to the reporter who broke the story about the University of Maryland Medical System Board, Luke Broadwater of the Baltimore Sun. Mr. Broadwater, well done, sir. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Tom. Good afternoon.
You've done great reporting on this, and it was kind of stunning to hear a day ago or so that that the mayor, when asked about this, said that the reporting, she characterized the reporting as a witch hunt that was just so redolent of Mr. Trump. But the mayor really is in the middle of this. What can you tell us about how this has evolved from her standpoint?
Sure, yes. I mean, the mayor is the most high-profile person involved formerly on the University of Maryland medical system board of directors who has resigned. But she's far from the only person. There are three resignations now from the board. There are four others placed on leave, and the CEO has just been placed on leave as well. He runs the whole system and is paid more than $4 million by the board. So there's been a lot of fallout over these stories. There's emergency legislation introduced in Annapolis now to try to fix some of these practices the board was undertaking. Most notably, the no bid contract deals with board members. And that's going to be heard today at 1 o'clock. That seems to have wide bipartisan support so far.
There's been a somewhat changing and evolving stance from the mayor about this when you first reported it. A couple of days after that, she amended some ethics forms that she had previously submitted when she was in the state Senate. She has now returned $100,000 to the University of Maryland Medical System. She's been asked about her tax returns, whether or not she thought it would be a good idea to release those. Let's unpack a little bit of that. The ethics forms? Let's start with that. That was last Friday night. She did that. What were on those forms originally, and how did she amend them?
So, Mayor Catherine Pugh, when she was in the state Senate, which she was a longtime state lawmaker before she won the mayor's race. She had sat on the finance committee and was the chair of the subcommittee that oversaw health care. At the same time, she was sitting on the board of the University of Maryland Medical System and entered into this series of deals for which there actually is no contract. There were no bids to buy her self-published children's books. Over the course of time, she was paid $500,000 from the medical system. It's still unclear who awarded this contract. The CEO of the system was hauled down to Annapolis and submitted to tough questioning behind closed doors from both the Senate president and the governor. And they came out of that meeting with no clear answer as to who approved this deal with the mayor. So in response to this, we looked at her ethics forms from her time as a state senator, and she had not disclosed her Healthy Holly LLC during that time for 7 years. Once we went to the mayor's office about this, she that night filed 7 years of amended forms going back to 2001, and she did list the Healthy Holly LLC through which she sold these books.
And we should say that in 2001, that's when she joined the board of the University of Maryland Medical System. She was not in the Senate at that point. I mean, at that point,
She joined the board in 2001. The Healthy Holly book was first sold in 2011.
Right.
I misspoke.
Right. But by the time of 2011, she was in the legislature at that point. But in 2001, when she joined the board, she was on this Baltimore City Council. She was not yet in Annapolis, right?
Yes. And my understanding was she joined the board as its community representative and stayed on the board. By law, it says you're supposed to be on for 5 years, a five-year term. But she stayed on the board till, you know, just Monday. So she was on the board for well past the end of the term.
And she was appointed to the board by then Governor O'Malley, right?
Correct. You're appointed by the governor. And the way it works, and this, I think some of the reform legislation is going to tighten this up, but if you weren't replaced on the board, you just stayed on it. So even though your term ended, if the next governor didn't come in and say, you're off, you just stayed on the board. And there are a number of people who were on the board for well past the end of the five-year term.
And she has asserted that she's done nothing wrong. She's paid taxes on this money that she's profited with her company that she owns, the Healthy Holly LLC. She's gone to great lengths to explain that it's not just a book company. It's a company that promotes health and healthy lifestyles for children. She herself is certainly a fitness buff, to be sure. She's a runner, and this is something she's had a long interest in. The Baltimore Marathon, tradition that happens every October, is due in large part to her effort and her advocacy. But the fact that she returned $100,000, what does that mean, and how has she explained her decision to do that?
Well, yeah, so she called me the other day and said she was returning the money, the $100,000 of the money. Once this blew up, once she saw the public outcry over it, she realized there were serious concerns from the public, from lawmakers, from the leaders of the state about what was going on at UMS. And she thought rather than go forward with the final book being bought by UMS, I'll return that portion of the money. So the way it works is she had really five different books. Each one was sold for $100,000 a piece for 20,000 copies, according to the mayor. This last one, she had received the money for it, but had not yet delivered the book or finished the book. So she returned this last portion of the money.
And is there anybody who is asserting, either on the what you call the UMS board, the UMMS, the University of Maryland Medical System board, that somehow providing children's books to the Baltimore City school system or daycare centers or other places is somehow very firmly in the mission of the University of Maryland Medical System?
So the CEO at first tried to argue that. He came down to Annapolis and he said, this is a win-win. We care about the health of kids. The mayor wrote a book about the health of kids. And, you know, it's a win-win. So that was his argument at first. I think then upon further reflection from hearing from the outcry of people who care about proper contracting practices, about competitive bids. There was a lot of outcry about self-dealing. The concern of the public and what this legislation would address is if you want to buy a children's book, if that's in your mission, you should put it out to bid. You should see what other children books are out there. What's the best one? Which has the most research? What is the what's a fair practice for the public? You shouldn't just look around your board and say, who wants a deal? And that's the concern of the legislature, and that's why this legislation would ban no-bid contracting with board members.
For example, these books are not available on Amazon.com or at Barnes & Noble, right? I mean, this is a self-published book that has only been sold to the University of Maryland Medical System. It's not been available anywhere else. Is that correct?
So the mayor has varied a little bit in her statements on that. She told my colleague, UMS was her only major client. She told me that she sometimes takes them to book sales and book fairs and things. So she may have sold some other copies outside of UMS, but she told one of my colleagues that really UMS was the major purchaser of these books.
There was also an issue because the University of Maryland Medical System at one point listed the purchase of these books as a grant, and that seems to be in violation of Internal Revenue Service regulations. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so it seems to be there was some disconnect between whoever it was at UMS that awarded this deal to the mayor, the CEO has yet to say who that person was, and the people who filed the taxes for UMS. Because at several times they listed it in several different ways. One year they said it was a $100,000 grant to the school system. And now if you talk to the school system, they said they didn't ask for the books, didn't encourage people to read the books, and a lot of the books are sitting in a warehouse. They don't view them as an essential a part of their mission or as the kind of book they would have purchased to give to kids. So there's that. I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought.
Well, I think that's all we need to talk about. That you know, when they list it as a grant, that's not what they were.
So the university. That's right. That's what I was saying. So one year they listed as a grant to the school system, and then another year they listed as a grant to Healthy Holly LLC. So it's unclear in terms of their tax and how they're reporting these things as taxes, what they really believe they were doing, and whether this was, in their view, charity or something else. And who was the receipt of the charity? Was it the mayor and her company, or was it the school system? Should these have been listed as grants? Should for-profit books to a politician be listed as grants? There are questions surrounding that as well.
And the reaction in Annapolis was swift and pretty severe. Mike Miller, Mike Bush, the president of the Senate and the Speaker of the House, respectively, as well as the governor, used words like appalling and, you know, unacceptable. This meeting that happened with the now about to be on leave CEO of the medical system, this is Robert Trenchik, sort of pummeled him with questions, according to what we know from that closed-door meeting, but he didn't seem to have too many answers. And do you think that was one of the reasons that the University of Maryland Medical System Board decided the next day to place him on a leave of absence, which he'll begin on Monday?
I would suspect that meeting was very key. The board chairman and the CEO both walked into that meeting. From what I understand, the leadership in Annapolis frankly berated them, and they left very humbled, and then the board took this action with the CEO. So, I think that meeting was very instructive.
And, of course, there are now two bills, and we'll talk about that with Pam Wood and Rachel Bay after a break. But I wonder, Luke, how did you come to know about this story and to begin writing about it?
Yeah, so Senator Jill Carter called me. I think it was a Sunday. She said, I had a complaint from one of my constituents who's a minority contractor who's been trying to get work with UMS, with the medical system, and they can't get work. And they're looking around. They see, in their view, less qualified firms who are just better connected who are getting the work. And I've been trying to look into it. I've been trying to get financial disclosure forms from UMS, and I can't get them. Could you help me out? And I said, of course, Senator. And so I reached out to the medical system. I asked for the financial disclosure forms for board members. They would not supply me with them. They said it's not our practice to give those out. So it took me 2 or 3 days to hunt them down. They're filed with a state commission, but not the state ethics commission that's in Annapolis that people usually check with. Once I got them, I saw there were 9 board members, not just the mayor, who had deals with the medical system for various services. I mean, there's people with consulting contracts, $13,000 a month to consult, who are sitting on the board. And I published that story. I frankly didn't expect it to blow up the way it did, but it's certainly the reaction was has been really intense. The Speaker of the House called it the biggest scandal he can recall in the legislature.
And he's been around a while, and there have been a few scandals in his time.
Right.
Yeah, that's saying something.
Well, that's quite a strong statement. Yeah. But Mike Miller called it a disaster. So there's a lot of concern in Annapolis, and really trying to reform this board and make sure that what Mike Miller, what Peter Franchot, what others are calling self-dealing stops happening on this board.
Luke Broadwater covers the State House for the Baltimore Sun. Luke, thank you for this reporting, and thanks for your time today. We will certainly keep on it and keep in touch with you.
Thanks, Tom.
We'll have more, by the way, on the University of Maryland medical system story on midday Monday. I'm going to speak with an expert in board ethics and a representative from Common Cause Maryland about best practices for nonprofit boards and what we should expect from our political leaders who may have interactions with them. So that's all coming up Monday on midday. Coming up today, after a quick break, Rachel Bay and Pamela Wood join me. We're going to talk about some of the other issues that the Maryland legislature has been working on. The midday news wrap continues in 90 seconds. I'm Tom Hall. I am not above begging. Please stay with us. And welcome back. It's the Midday News Wrap. By the way, coming up a little later today, some live music here in Studio A with the Local Honeys, an acoustic duo from Kentucky. They'll do a few old-time hillbilly bluegrass tunes. But first, a look at some of the bills that are making their way through the legislative process in the Maryland General Assembly. Last Monday was crossover day. If a bill has a decent prospect of ultimately being enacted by the end of the General Assembly session in April, it needed to pass either the House or the Senate by last Monday. Some did, some didn't. Joining me now to get us up to speed, Rachel Bay, who covers the State House for WIPR. How are you doing, Rachel?
I'm good. How are you?
And Pamela Wood, who does the same for the Baltimore Sun. Hey, Pam.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Good, thanks. So let's talk real quick to finish up our discussion about this kerfluffle at the University of Maryland Medical System, Pam. There is a bill that Senator Jill Carter has sponsored, SB 619. There's also a bill in the House. What's the status of those? I think they're trying to fast-track these, aren't they?
Yes, they absolutely are trying to fast-track these. Interestingly, Senator Carter's bill had kind of gone without a lot of attention until my colleague Luke Broadwater's reporting on this. That's had a hearing, and it's kind of pending action. Yesterday, House Speaker Michael Bush put in a bill, and it has actually got multiple votes to send it right to committee. It has a committee hearing starting in about half an hour this afternoon, where it will be discussed by state delegates. And there is clearly an intention to get the details worked out and get a bill passed quickly.
Yeah, and Rachel, it's interesting because Delegate Nick Kipke, who is the minority leader, the Republican minority leader, I guess, introduced Speaker Bush's bill on his behalf because he had a medical appointment and couldn't be there the other day. I mean, that's pretty unprecedented, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's not terribly unprecedented, honestly. You'll have sometimes Republicans introducing bills, especially if they're bipartisan efforts like this. This is something that people across the political spectrum have been pretty upset about in Annapolis. So I would not be surprised to see this get bipartisan, these pieces of legislation get bipartisan support.
Yeah, it sounds like this is a big moment for bipartisanship. Pam Wood, the governor, Larry Hogan, really had an extraordinary press conference the other day on Monday, on crossover day, in which he was pretty rough on the democratically controlled legislature. What was the tone of that meeting?
Yeah, absolutely. The governor was pretty intense and forceful with his criticism of the General Assembly. The governor has been pretty quiet since the first few weeks when we had the inauguration and the State of the State. He's kind of not been involved himself. And then he had a press conference with about 3 weeks to go. He said lawmakers were being reckless in some of their decisions in mandated spending for education in future years. He called them pro-criminal. That was largely related to the failed effort to pass a law requiring Baltimore City School police officers to carry their guns inside buildings. He just didn't see any sense in that, and he was just full of criticism for the legislature.
So it's interesting. I mean, I guess depending on the issue, some things are going to get bipartisan and some things are going to stay pretty partisan. It's interesting. So, Rachel, the $15 minimum wage, this is something that's been introduced in prior sessions without success, but it looks like it's closer to happening this time.
Well, it remains to be seen to one extent, which is that the governor hasn't yet said whether he will sign it or veto it. He has expressed a lot of displeasure about this particular legislation. But the House and the Senate have agreed to a compromise that was sent to the governor's desk. And so at this point, we're just waiting to find out what the governor will do.
But there will be a bill. You think the bill will pass? The compromise bill will probably make it through?
It already has passed.
It has passed.
It has passed. And it did pass in both chambers with enough votes to override a potential veto. Mm-hmm. So the compromise has the minimum wage reaching $15 an hour in 2025, except for small businesses with fewer than 15 employees would have a more delayed implementation. So they wouldn't see $15 until the following year.
But the governor hasn't tipped his hand about whether he thinks this is a decent enough compromise. He's never been a big fan of the $15 minimum wage, you know, as a general political concept. But what about this particular bill? Do we have any indication?
Well, we do, actually. He said both on Monday at the press conference and also in a letter to leaders prior to the press conference, he said that this was going to cost the state. The figure he gave was 99,000 jobs, billions of dollars in economic output over the next decade. And he offered in his letter that he sent to leadership a little while ago now, he did offer some of what he perceived to be compromises, but those didn't get any attention at all in the legislature.
And Pam Wood, the bill to ban tobacco sales for people under the age of 21, I know the Legislative Black Caucus was very, very much behind that. Where does that stand?
Yeah, I just want to go back real quick on the minimum wage, just to add that the governor, as Rachel said, is clearly does not like this bill. He wants a $12 an hour minimum wage, but he has not used the veto word yet. And we've asked all of us reporters have asked his office multiple times about that, and he won't say whether he's going to veto it or not, although he's clearly not supportive. So, yeah, with tobacco and nicotine going to age 21, versions of that have passed both chambers. There's one key difference is that the Senate put in an exemption for the military, that if you have a military ID and you are 18, 19, or 20, you could still purchase tobacco and nicotine products. The House considered that and rejected that change. So that's the one sort of big detail that needs to be ironed out before they pass that on to the governor.
And Rachel, a couple of energy bills, the renewable energy bill, and also a thing about trash incineration and whether or not they're going to be eligible for green subsidies. What's the status of those?
So that's actually one bill. Mm-hmm. So right now, trash incineration is eligible for state subsidies. It's classified as renewable energy under the state law, under a law that was passed in 2011. So there's a bill to increase the amount of electricity the state gets from renewable sources to 50% by the year 2030. Right now, we had had the goal was 25%. So this would increase that benchmark. And the bill passed the Senate with this addition that trash incineration would no longer qualify as renewable, meaning it wouldn't qualify for these state subsidies that it gets. It's not clear what's going to happen with the bill in the House. The House committee, the bill had kind of hit a stalemate in the House committee where it didn't get enough votes to either kill the bill or support the bill. So now with the Senate bill going through the House, it's kind of another chance to look at it. It's not clear what's going to happen, though.
And Pam Wood, a bunch of former mayors showed up in Annapolis to speak on behalf of keeping the Preakness at Pimlico. There's a lot going on with that in these last this last week or 10 days. What can you tell us about the status of all that?
Yes, we had the current mayor, Catherine Pugh, and three former mayors, Stephanie Rawlings-Blake, Martin O'Malley, and Kurt Schmoke, came down to Annapolis to meet with the Legislative Black Caucus yesterday. And they made a plea, really, for the Black Caucus to join them in trying to defeat a bill that basically would make it easier for the Stronach Group, which owns Laurel and Pimlico racetracks, to invest in Laurel. They have this vision of a super track, a really expansive track, and they hope to attract large, big-name races there, and many fear that that would spell the end of the Preakness in Baltimore. So Mayor Pugh and the other mayors made their case to the Black Caucus, hey, get on our side, help us kill this bill so we can protect Pimlico and the Preakness.
Because there is a law, right? There is a law that says, you know, can't be moved from the Preakness unless there's, you know, some act of God or, you know, unpredictable catastrophe. I know Delegate Sandy Rosenberg has you know, been trumpeting that law for as long as people have been talking about this. There's nothing that's changed with that. Is there any danger that that law could be changed by the legislature? There's a whole lot of people in that body who don't live in the city of Baltimore and maybe don't care so much about whether or not the Preakness is in Pimlico or at Laurel.
That's right. Actually, in the Legislative Black Caucus meeting yesterday, some of the lawmakers from other areas were kind of asking, looking for more information about the Park Heights and Pimlico neighborhoods, trying to understand the importance of the Preakness Stakes and Pimlico. They were looking for that. Now, nothing's going to happen this year in changing that law that requires basically an emergency or disaster situation to move the Preakness. That's not going to happen this year, but certainly that would be a roadblock for Stronach Group, that law, which dates to the 1980s, if and when they try and move the Preakness from Pimlico to Laurel.
And is Mayor Pugh suing the Stronach Group as well?
That's right. She sure is. Earlier this week, the mayor filed a lawsuit in Baltimore City Circuit Court trying to block any move of the Preakness. She says that there are no emergency or disaster conditions other than anything that Stronach has created themselves by failing to invest in their track. She also wants to prevent the state from issuing bonds to finance the work at Laurel. That's what the Laurel financing bill would do. So she's trying to block that, even though that bill hasn't passed yet, and actually seeking the court to award ownership of the property and the Preakness Stakes itself to the city of Baltimore. So quite an ambitious set of asks there in the mayor's lawsuit.
Yeah, Rachel, what do you think?
Yeah, well, and one other thing to add is that Senate President Mike Miller mentioned earlier this week that by filing that lawsuit, Pew kind of tied the General Assembly's hands. He said that they don't like to pass legislation while litigation is pending. So there, it's not clear whether they would continue to move forward on this bond issue for Laurel, given the litigation. And he said that they're going to have to look at the litigation and see what it looks like.
Yeah, as they say on Facebook, it's complicated. Mm-hmm. Pam, here's a clip of you're asking a question of Governor Hogan at that press conference that we talked about that happened on Monday concerning crime.
If you're a repeat violent offender who continually gets arrested for committing violent crimes with a gun, you need to go to jail. Our legislators are voting against that. The argument about whether we should have more police officers in Baltimore City should not be an argument. Baltimore City, where most of the violent crime is taking place, the only place in the state where we're not allowing police officers, trained school resource officers, cannot carry a weapon, is crazy. I mean, this seems to be like the most pro-criminal group of legislators I've ever seen.
Well, evidently, Pam, that wasn't your question, but that's what I was told, but that's fine. But, the governor, when it comes to crime and when it comes to gun legislation, I mean, he's been very, very consistent. There are a couple of bills that are moving their way through. One would abolish the Gun Permit Review Board, the Handgun Permit Review Board. What's up with that?
That's actually being debated on the floor of the Senate as we speak, upstairs from where I'm sitting here in the State House. The Handgun Permit Review Board is where you go when you're a handgun owner and you want to have a permit to carry your gun, kind of a concealed carry permit, a lot of people call it. It's a wear and carry permit. You go to the state police and ask them, but you have to, under the law, show what's called a good and substantial reason. And often the state police turn people down or they put restrictions on when and where you can carry your gun. So if you don't like that decision, you can go to this board. It is 5 civilians appointed by the governor. And in the past few years, they've been hearing a whole bunch of cases. And the vast majority of the time, they're overturning or modifying the state police decisions. They're quite permissive and allowing people to carry these handguns all the time, which, of course, is concerning to gun violence prevention advocates, gun control advocates. So there's a bill that would eliminate that handgun permit review board. Instead, a gun owner would appeal to an administrative hearing judge, and that is currently pending in the Senate, hasn't seen action yet in the House.
And the House evidently gave approval on Monday to some bills that have to do with banning 3D printed guns. It's pretty amazing mm-hmm. to think that you can print a gun on your 3D printer. Pam, where does that stand now?
Yeah, that's passed the House and is now in the Senate for consideration. There's some question of, is this really a problem? Are people actually making these guns? Are they ever used, let alone used in, you know, a harmful or criminal way? But lawmakers want to get ahead of this. And so that has passed the House and moved to the Senate. There's also a bill that will require background checks for private sales of long guns, such as shotguns and rifles, that also has been approved by the House and is now pending in the Senate.
And that, I guess, Rachel, is intended to fill a loophole, because now you have to have background checks if you purchase them from a dealer. But I guess private purchases are not covered by that part of the statute. So they're trying to fill that gap. Huh?
That's exactly right. And it's often called the gun show loophole around the country. But that bill actually came in a lot stricter for those long guns, and it was very controversial. The proposal was to create a handgun or a license for long guns just like there is for handguns, but that faced a lot of opposition by gun rights advocates, and so it was watered down a good bit.
And
but they're still opposed to that bill.
Yeah.
Absolutely. They do not want those background checks. Gun owners say, look, this is how most people obtain and sell guns to one another, and this puts an onerous a requirement on something that's been going on for forever.
Yeah, I guess one of your stories reported that there were folks up in the gallery while they were having this conversation screaming, "We will not comply."
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that
sort of shows the level of emotion behind it. Pam, one other thing as we finish up here, the death with dignity legislation, the end of life legislation. I guess there's a key meeting about that, committee meeting today, right?
This afternoon, the Senate's Judicial Proceedings Committee will hold a vote on their version of the End of Life Options Act, as it's called. It allows certain terminally ill patients to request a prescription of a drug they could take to end their lives. And the committee spent a little more than 7 hours yesterday afternoon, well into the night, hashing out a lot of the details of the bill. They changed it significantly from what happened in the House of Delegates, and they'll take their vote on it this afternoon, send it to the full Senate next week. And the sponsor of the bill, interestingly, is Senator Will Smith, whose last day is Thursday. He's heading on a Navy deployment to Afghanistan. So there's some urgency from some of the supporters of this bill to get it passed before he leaves.
And Sine Die is coming up April 8th, just a few weeks. So we will stay in touch with both of you guys to figure out what's happening between now and then. Pamela Wood covers all things Annapolis for the Baltimore Sun, and Rachel Bay covers Maryland politics as part of the news team here at WIPR. Thanks to you both, and have a good weekend.
You too.
Thank you, Tom.
Coming up after a quick break, music from the bluegrass and Appalachian regions of Kentucky. We'll meet the local honeys right after this break. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.